There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast.
On the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
All right, this is the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel. That's Marcus Parks.
He's in free speech jail.
You're in free speech jail.
Yeah, but this time, Ben, you were the one that put him in free speech jail.
So there you go. It's your first time here with me, my friend, and it gets a lot harder than with Marcus.
I got to say, your locker room talk is starting to sound a little bit more like Abu Ghraib, but you know what I'm saying?
I don't tell me how to be.
All right. It's Halloween, fuckers.
This is Halloween, and today's episode, in honor of Halloween, our favorite month, is October. We do scary listener pastas, and that's what we have today.
This is an actual successful listener pasta.
It is.
I think we have a good buffet of creepy.
A lot of military stories this year,
and they're awesome.
Yeah,
because they've seen some shit. They've done some stuff. We've done nothing.
No, we're lazy. They're the heroes.
We literally sit. With three microphones.
Yeah.
I mean, we reek of beer.
Oh, sure.
My body is sweat under my tits. I've done nothing.
Nothing.
You know what I mean? I'm not in Iraq right now. I'm not running around with a vest on, 10-foot fucking exoskeleton.
We're going to get to those. All right, everyone. So enjoy the episode, and let's just kick it off with our first listener pasta.
Listener pasta 2, you do it again.
That's the name of the sequel?
You do it again.
You do it. You do it this time.
You do it one more time. You take over and do it.
All right. Enjoy. Now we've got a story from one of our personal favorites, Sergeant Goldenthroat. He called in on the last listener pasta episode, told a wonderful tale, and I would assume he has a similar one for us here today.
You better, because the last time your story was the best one,
yes.
And it's the reason why we can continue to do listener pastas without getting total, complete waves of bullshit.
Yeah, we're only getting half waves of bullshit right now.
Right, hi guys, and hello to all the listeners. Nice to be back. Felt some love over the last year for the... snake-handed horror last year that went down pretty well. Mm-hmm. As I think you guys, you probably remember, just to fill people in case they haven't listened to it. I work for the British government. I'm currently seconded with the military, so there was a kind of military security angle to last year's story, if you remember.
And that is completely true. That is what was great about that story. Is I mean, like, you do work for the government. That's why you are under an assumed name.
No, that's his actual government-given name, Sergeant Goldenthroat.
Sergeant Hardrod. Goldenthroat.
Yes, he facilitates the generals.
That's right, yeah. Obviously, I can't go into huge detail on this because there's a lot of sensitivity surrounding it. But suffice to say, I think Henry's nailed it last year when he said that the higher-ups know about all kinds of weird shit that's going on around the world with regard to military security issues, but it's just not shared. And that's true about just conventional security, but it's also true about some of the, I think, what's best described as weird shit that goes on from time to time. But this year, I've got something for you that's not up to the minute, but is 100 years old. So I'm going to take you back in time to the trenches of the Somme, September 1916. I don't know if you know about the Somme, but it was the most horrific battle of the First World War.
See, when I hear the word Somme, I think of that fucking documentary with all the guys smelling wine, saying that they smell like tennis balls.
Yes.
And cedar chips.
Sommelier,
yes.
I think you mean.
I love it.
That's something different. And so, well, you wouldn't have been smelling wine on that day, because 57,000 British troops were injured on the first day.
Cool.
And probably 25,000 soldiers on both sides were killed. It was appalling. Anyway, the story I've got comes from just before the first day of that battle. So here it is. I've been researching it in the archives. It'll become clear later on. So here's the story. A lot of it is actually in the form of a letter written by a British soldier. So I'll read that to you in just a minute. His name was Private Alfred James Lewis, and he was fighting with G Company of the Royal Light Infantry Fusiliers, which were part of the Norfolk Regiment. And he wrote home to his parents, and we've got hold of that letter, and it's pretty amazing. I don't know if you guys can see, but... I've actually got a copy of the letter here.
And it's written in real British calligraphy.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And you can see it's been stamped there. It's
most
been in the
secret.
It's been in the archives for just over 100 years, as I say, but it's now been released. So here it is. Shall I just read his letter? It's pretty remarkable. I think it speaks for itself, really. So here it comes. So this is Private Lewis. And we should remember that, you know, this guy was a young man in an extraordinary position. Anyway, here it comes. Dear Mother and Father, the autumn is a very bad one. The rain is incessant, and it's very hard to believe I shall see you again. The food is good this week. Last week we ran out of biscuits and ended up with just soup for 4 days. But our spirits are higher this week. I'm not allowed to tell you very much, of course, but there are new companies arriving who are having success against the Germans. What I want to tell you is a strange tale, and I trust you will believe me. I've been sleeping all right, and I'm of sound mind. I feel I must tell someone, in case I do not return to tell the tale. 3 nights ago, I was on night watch duty from midnight to 4 o'clock. The German lines are only perhaps 200 yards from our trench, and with my binoculars, I could see them moving about, their lanterns glowing. All seemed quiet, but at just before 2, a commotion could be heard. A German shouted in pain, and then more voices joined the clamour. My commanding officer woke at the noise and ordered that a flare be sent up. He feared an attack. Under the brilliant phosphorus glare, I saw a sight that I hope I shall never see again. A great, dark figure was moving along the German trench, perhaps 20 feet tall. Whether it was in the shape of man or beast, I cannot say. It had arms, I think, and legs, but how many, I cannot say. It seemed to be made of smoke or billows of dark dust, always shifting and twisting like knots of matted hair. My commanding officer swore an oath at the sight and sent up another flare. Now we could see clearly. The boys in the trench with me were dumbfounded. A few could not watch. But I saw it all. This creature, or wraith, or whatever it was, seemed to lift German soldiers from their trench one by one and pick them apart as if they were spiders in the hands of a schoolboy. The popping sound, the delicate rip of flesh in the otherwise dead, silent night, will live with me forever. Limbs dropped into the mud with a splash. A head would fall under the light of the flare, a shadow rushing to meet it as it fell heavily into the filth. The beast was working methodically left to right, apparently clearing the entire trench, taking the torsos it had dismembered into its maw, where they slipped obscenely into the reeds of its darkness. It seemed to shrink and grow from time to time, never still, never one shape, always sliding indecently along the earth, ever moving, never still, but silent. Utterly silent it was. The only sounds, the gurgles and screams of the German troops. I almost felt sorry for them. Were we to be next? Suddenly it all stopped. The shapeless thing lurched to the right, out of the light of our flares, and disappeared into the darkness. It was done. All that was left was the commotion of the Germans moving about in their trench, frantic cries and moans drifting across the damp air. We looked at each other, hardly believing what we'd seen. Our commanding officer ordered us to tell no one, and we have done as we've been told. I write this to you in the belief that someone should know what I saw, and in the hope that the regimental censors allow my words to reach England, even if they must remain secret for now. I send you all my love and hope, and pray that you never have to experience the sight I saw this last week. We fear very much that the creature might return. Does it know or care which side of the lines we're on? Does it have even a base intelligence? Is it of this world or another? I miss you all so very much, and although I'm due leave before Christmas, I think perhaps I shall not see you in England again. We hear such tales from the front. In hope, and with my most heartfelt sincerity, Alfred.
Rock and roll.
I gotta say, if I'm Alfred's parents, you go to the mailbox, you know, someone, a mailman delivers you a letter, like, oh, we have a message from our son. I can't wait to read it. Hope everything is going well.
Why
and he sends him that. I think
you
gotta lie to your parents.
Why does it always have to be creepy? You never send a nice
the thing
one.
Is,
you gotta lie
thing
to your parents. Tell them everything is going great.
The thing is, boys, you see, this letter never got to his parents. You see, it did end up in the hands of the regimental censor. And it ended up in the regimental archives until the end of the war. And then after the armistice was signed in 1918, it was deposited in the Imperial War Museum in London. And it's been under a Section H notice ever since then. That's kind of like the British military X-Files, effectively. Mm. And they're not open to anyone, even those of us, you know, not just any researcher, but even to those of us working for the government until 100 years later. So, you know, this is early, early days. But I have found two other things which just support this very briefly. One is I've got a colleague in Berlin in the German military who's doing something similar with the Reichsarchive in Berlin.
Oh, man, and that's got to be fucking complicated and weird.
Well, that's right.
All friends
in Europe now, of course.
just going through, fact, like, we, no, we, no, this whole drawer is just filled with human teeth.
we even get on quite well with the Poles, actually.
Hmm.
But here we go. He found a telegraph communication that the Germans sent, and it reads, do you want to do it in German, or should I just do the translation?
Do the translation, right?
Well, let's hear a little bit in German first, and then get some translation.
Sure. Okay, Donnerstagabend, ein Monster überkam uns. Es gibt keine Überlebenden. Haben die Briten eine neue Waffe? Schreckliche Szenen spielten sich ab. Nicht einmal Körperteile lassen sich zusammenbinden. Wenig bleibt den Männern. Wir warten.
Kissel, please put your hands down.
All right, Mr. Golden, Sergeant Golden Throat. Now do it in a human language.
Yeah, that translates as follows. This is word for word. It comes across as this. Thursday night, a monster visited us. No survivors. Do the British have some new weapon?
God.
Terrible scenes. We cannot even gather the body parts. Little remains of the men. We await the dawn.
Cool.
So that's one thing. So that kind of confirms that there was some serious shit going down.
What a stressful day.
What a stressful day
when you can't even gather all the body parts.
I know.
You know, there's just so many body parts.
And the Nazis were so organized.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. These weren't Nazis. This is 30 years earlier.
They're the free baby Nazis. They're the Muppet Babies.
Proto-Nazis. Baby Nazis.
Baby Nazis. That's, well, Hitler was in there somewhere, but still. Anyway, I visited the little museum, just this last little thing. I visited the museum near where this incident was reported, and it's like a little municipal French museum, and it's got loads of exhibits about the Great War and tanks and the Battle of the Somme and so on. But upstairs, there's a kind of little older history corner, and I found this woodcut sitting in a corner, a little picture, very, very bizarre, almost kind of psychedelic swirls in the form of some creature, maybe a man, maybe an animal. It's not clear. The text, I won't do my best late medieval French on you, but it's 16th century, I think. The French translates as follows. It says, drawn from life, a horror visited the village this spring. It took the children. We abandon the village today. Pray no one ever returns. The dead are walking here. Only the dead will inhabit this land. And the last bit of this story is that Private Lewis, from whom we heard there, he did indeed never see England again. His service record lists him as missing, presumed dead, on September the 22nd, which I think was only a couple of days after he wrote that letter. And there are no details, but his entire company met the same fate. No military action occurred at that part of the front line that night. And his precise fate remains unknown.
Interesting.
That's interesting. It's almost like a Cadbury egg for this monster creature, but instead of having that really wonderful fake egg, gooey, sugary inside, they just had soup. Apparently, I would hate to kill somebody, gut him, and then next thing you know, 4 days worth of soup. Nothing on the inside you want.
Only soup. I guess they must have run out of biscuits.
That's what he was there for.
Actually, you hear a lot about, you know, paranormal activity happening during war, you know, especially UFO activity, cryptic activity. It's like, obviously, this is some sort of, like, maybe collected energy that comes out of war.
This wasn't the only paranormal thing to happen during World War One. There was always also the Angel of Mons that appeared during another.
Yes, Mons
British...
is where the pubic hair is.
Oh, is that right?
I mean, you're right though, Mark, because there are a hell of a lot of weird stories about very strange shit going down in World War One. I mean, I've got various others that I'm working on at the moment, but more generally in battle situations, there's a lot of strange things out there.
Awesome. I also want to clarify, Sergeant Goldenthroat said the private heard the Germans shouting in pain. That was them laughing, and he just... that's fun. That's how they express joy.
It was just a cultural misunderstanding, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes.
I think that's very likely, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Two for two. You always bring such great stories. Thank you, Sergeant Goldenthroat.
Yeah, Magustalations, boys.
Magustalations.
Indeed.
We've got another caller. This guy, he's amazing. He came to the live show in London both nights. So thank you so much for coming. His name is Neil, and he's got some incredible stories for you.
He's handsome. He's got a Van Dyke. Right, yeah. On his face.
Which sounds, it sounds face. Bad. I didn't realize that was, it's a conquistador look.
Yes, it is a conquistador.
Yes. Thanks, okay. Thanks for being here, Neil.
That's great. Thank you for having me.
So where does your story begin?
Okay, I've got two stories which were told to me by my mother. They're quite unusual stories. I mean, she's quite sensitive to things like ghosts, but these are quite out there.
Is she a difficult woman as well? Is she difficult across the board? Or
you want to call his mother a difficult woman?
My mom is sensitive as well, quote unquote, yes. But she's also a very difficult woman.
Neil, is your mother a difficult woman?
I guess, yeah. I mean, she's a Yorkshire woman, so she's quite a...
Difficult, yeah. You know? I dated a Yorkshire woman for quite a while. They're very difficult.
Well, they're wonderful people, and we all love them.
Expert-level women.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I totally believe that these things happen to her, although we just can't explain what they were. But we can't kind of debunk them in any way. So, basically, she grew up on a farm in Yorkshire in the countryside. And when she was around 7 years old-ish, this was in the 1950s, she was playing outside next to a barn. And she looked up and she saw two giant, massive, gnarled, hairy, dirty hands coming over the top of the barn. And the barn's like... house height, so massive. And then she saw this face coming up over the barn as well, and that was kind of really grotesque looking. And she looks back and then she sees like the typical fairy tale troll face. And she sees it coming over the top. She's frozen in fear, and she kind of sees it almost debating whether or not to actually climb up onto the barn. And yeah, and then it kind of just kind of backed off and disappeared. She just basically just ran inside and didn't tell anyone about it because it is pretty far-fetched.
I mean, could have just been a basketball player.
possibly.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
Neil, you're very small. Like, you're a very small man. And your mom is also, I imagine, probably smaller than you.
Oh, yeah, she's smaller than me, so... Yeah.
It literally could have been Ben.
It could have been me trying to fix your damn barn, and then your mother screamed, called me a troll,
Where's
and left crying.
Where's the shitter in this barn?
You gotta make one yourself.
Well, Yorkshire... Like they have a lot of like fairy stories in it. Like it's a very like folklore based area of England, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I looked into it afterwards, and apparently the Yorkshire countryside is quite notorious for trolls. Apparently, but you know, it's kind of Yorkshire people in general are quite troll looking. So I don't know, but we can't start kind of debunk it because it's kind of a she said she didn't dream it. I mean, it was a time when like she didn't have a TV, so she couldn't like that couldn't influence her or anything.
Well,
so
no TVs. All you could do is go outside, look at the barn, hope you see a troll.
Well, it's kind of like Ed Gein when he would look up and seeing the crows and all the bones and trees and shit like that. Yeah. He made his own TV.
You got to.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, maybe. But yeah, it's just such a bizarre story. So
I love that. Shit.
How old was your mother when she told you this story? You said it happened to her when she was 7. How long did she hold on to this for?
I don't know. I think I was like a teenager. I think it was kind of as I was having some strange experiences, and she talked to other people who had strange experiences, and she kind of brought it up, and it was kind of like she was very like solemn about it. You know, like really serious, so I totally believe that she saw it.
My belief system and your belief system is that reality it's thin. Obviously people have experienced these sorts of activity like all over the world. Every different culture has stories of the hidden people, and so I believe your mom.
Well, man, you build a barn, you're just asking for a troll to come climb on it.
It's like building a fucking baseball stadium, and you're just going to have a bunch of guys in baseball uniforms.
That's right.
They've got baseball bats.
They're baseball players.
But it turns out they're not baseball players. They're just a themed gang.
Oh, I see. Like the Warriors. Yeah. Neil, do you mind us asking, what was some of the experiences that you were going through when your mom, told you the troll story?
I don't know. There was kind of just some slightly spooky ones, but I've had a couple of, like, in the Matrix type ones.
Cool.
As well. So, they're quite...
And so you were a child expressing to your mother that you're going through some paranormal phenomenon, and to calm your nerves, she told you that trolls are real.
Don't worry, son. It literally only gets worse than this.
Yeah, you had one. But she had one more story, right?
Yeah, this was around the same sort of time. It's this is nuts as well. Her and some friends were playing in a field, and they passed a really kind of crude-looking scarecrow. You know, basically sticks with a hat and a coat on it. And they kind of got away, and they were about 40, 50 feet away from it. And they heard something, like her and her friends. I don't know how many friends were there, maybe about five. And they looked, and the scarecrow started running towards them.
Weird.
And they all saw it, and they all just ran and kind of didn't mention it again. But it was, again, trying to kind of debunk this, and it was like, she said it was literally a stick figure, and how it was running was like on the two kind of sticks that were kind of its legs, so it kind of just sort of tottering towards them, you know, at fast speed. But again, it's utterly bizarre. It's like, I can't really shit. It was just, obviously, there's no one around. Yeah. It was just flat fields.
I wonder if, like, at some point, your mom's friends were like, spooky shit only happens when we hang out with you.
Right. Yeah, I feel like this is so sad for the scarecrow and the troll. It seems like they just wanted to have friends.
You always sympathize with the monster.
Because they just want friends. He's a scarecrow. He's hanging out with crows all day. Or no, not even, because he's...
Will you please just give us a hug?
Give a scarecrow a hug.
Give us a hug.
Shake hands with a troll and hug a scarecrow.
I'm filled with insects.
Well, that's not good.
All right, we got to get on to our next caller. If I can, thank you so much for calling in, man.
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah, Satan.
Good to see you. We'll see you soon, dude.
Okay, we got another caller. This guy is Trevor Smith. He worked at Area 51. Henry, how aroused are you?
Quote unquote, Trevor Smith.
Uh-oh.
I am incredibly interested, of course. I know some people that worked for NASA. I was recently bumped into a girl
NASA
on the train.
Again?
Never a straight answer. Uh-huh. And I bumped into a girl that I used to work with at a night job about like 10 years ago. And she remember she had an aunt that worked at NASA, and she was explaining that the aunt would get drunk and be like, "We've been talking to aliens for 45 years." And yeah. I'm just like, if that's the truth, fucking give it to me.
Aliens also might be what she calls her ex-husband, which we don't know. So, Trevor, tell us, when did you start working at Area 51, and what's your experience been like there?
Well, I was first stationed there in early 2010, and I was there providing security for the actual installation itself. Through the Air Force, and my experience there was pretty weird.
Now, my question
to say
is,
the least.
Do they use a special polish to get all the claw marks and the reptilians off the tiles? Like, is that like a thing that you have to? Was that your job, or?
No. I kind of just walked around and made sure that no one was taking anything out of the installation they weren't supposed to. Nobody had their cell phones out. No one was taking any pictures, any recordings, anything like that. Just making sure everyone was staying on task.
Okay. Now, my question is, when you say the installation, is that a specific part of Area 51, or is that just like literally like the main underground level, or like what?
Area 51 is the entire, obviously, area, but the installation is the installation that is located underneath Groom Lake.
Okay.
So when you refer to the installation on Area 51, that's the installation that's responsible for the development of new technologies. They call it the installation. It's right underneath Groom Lake.
Okay. Cool. I'm really glad they don't call it, like, Wonka's Factory. They always have, because you said Paradise Ranch. There's, like, so many different names where it's like, yeah, Silly Town, USA, where it's where we may have all these new penis extenders, since, like, and it's very top secret.
The installation is horrifying, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, they've got some nomenclature name for it, but they just call it the installation.
Cool.
And this was in response to you guys in the last episode talking about people who served in the military and saw kind of a lot of bizarre things. And I got to witness the development of a lot of new equipment and weapon systems that are probably going to be coming into production, I guess, in like the next 20 years. I would say anything that you guys can see on the outside, online, on TV is an early prototype or a proof of concept, and that it's probably been in development for at least a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the coolest things that I saw when I was there was called the Beowulf armor, which is basically like I would liken it to like an exoskeleton or a large suit that a pilot would get into. And it's about 10 feet tall. And of course, I'm not an engineer, so I don't really know how any of this stuff works.
Cool.
But it's about 10 feet tall. And the pilot gets on a little step ladder. The front chest piece kind of opens up. The pilot steps in it, turns around, steps in it. The chest piece closes, and then they bring the helmet down and kind of screw the helmet on. So the helmet, like, you can't move your neck or anything like that. He's got like a 360-degree camera in there.
Cool.
Yeah, and so it's strong as fuck. Yeah, you can. I mean, they had like those heavy punching bags that are like 100 pounds, 150 pounds. They would have a bunch of those lined up. And the pilot and the Beowulf would just go up to him and just grab him and like rip him in half.
That's awesome.
So awesome.
Yeah, to test his grip strength.
Fuck yes.
And it can lift cars. I saw one incident where the pilot was lifting a car. He got down kind of on one knee, put one arm underneath the car, and put the other arm kind of on the side of the passenger door, and stood up and lifted the entire car. And it was like an Isuzu Rodeo or some little SUV. Lifted it up, and then he kind of went to put the other arm underneath the car and lifted over his head, and he kind of dropped it. So they ended the experiment right there.
Yes.
But yeah, it's capable of lifting a car well above its head. I know for a fact, because I was out at the range when they were testing the armor that I guess covers the Beowulf, and they were shooting at it with 50 cals. It can take like a direct fire from a 50 cal indefinitely. I mean, it wasn't getting through it at all.
If I could get one of these suits, I would never have to fuck ever again.
Yeah,
I would just walk around in the suit all day long feeling just confident and fulfilled.
Oh, it's pretty rad. But I should say there's levels to the installation. From what I know, there's about 15 levels. So I was cleared to go down to level 5. And when I was there, the highest rank I achieved was O2, or first lieutenant. And if you want to go down below those levels, you need special clearance. Or if you're actually commissioned or enlisted in the military, you need to be at least on the officer side of things, an O3 or above, a captain or above.
No, there's a lot and of there are a lot of private guys in there, too, like a lot of like Blackwater kind of guys walking around to the contractors in there.
Yeah, but that's a cover for just government agencies. Yeah. I mean, the people who get flown in from the airport, the kind of outer perimeter, the guards, the dudes who roll around in the white SUVs, you'll see them if you drive up close to Area 51.
Yeah, the guys that stop you from taking pictures. The guys that, like, show up.
Yeah, the fat kind of scrubs. I mean, they're just contractors, but they're part of a government agency, the DOD. I'm not exactly sure which one, but they'll call them contractors.
Right.
But, so I was only cleared for up to level 5. So there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on there that I really have no idea about.
No.
Well, it's interesting because I know the private company out of Boston, Boston Dynamics, they've been creating a lot of these works and a lot of the robotics in the private sector. Is there any idea or any information that they gave you regarding when they're actually going to start putting these to use, when they're actually going to start having these war machines come out and fight?
No, absolutely not. The only thing I could tell you, like I said, you know, I was basically a glorified internal security guard. So, I mean, I don't know how long a lot of this has been in development. I know that I asked, and the Beowulf has been kind of in the developmental phase for like 20 years or something. Huh. And I can give you a point of reference. Those helicopters they use in the bin Laden raid,
mm-hmm.
Those have been in development or in use for like the past 40 years. I mean, they're nothing new at all.
Right.
We've had the technology for that for a long time. And even when they did the raid, you know, it was still highly classified, but the thing had been around for a long time. So, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, you can go online and look and see where they're, you know, developing these kind of exoskeletons. And they're kind of small. I would guess it's just like a proof of concept, and they're, you know, able to to show the public. But the thing I saw was much further along. And one thing I wrote about, which was pretty badass, or at least I thought it was cool, was they have kind of like this crowd control device, which is basically like a huge baton that the Beowulf actually grabs. And I guess it's electrified or uses plasma. I couldn't exactly tell. But this thing can just wreck shop. I mean, they turn it on and kind of use it like a bat or, you know, a beating stick, and it can just destroy cars. It can go through concrete walls. It can go through steel. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what you would use. I was thinking that you could probably, you know, use it to stop a car from advancing or something like that. So maybe you'd get out there, a guy with this thing, and just, if a car was driving in an embassy or something, you just whack it with the stick.
I just love that people in Arkansas think that they can take their rifles and fight the government if they have to.
No way. And I'll tell you this, guys, you know, there's a lot of levels of security to actually getting into Area 51, let alone the installation. So those guys that get on the border, they're still like, I don't know, a mile or 2 mile, I'd estimate, from actually breaching the real installation.
Right.
No, I'm sure. We've heard rumors about Area 51. Of course, the big question is going to be, are there flying saucers there? Is the wrecked footage, the wreckage from Roswell, is it there? My question is, it's like, I feel like, of course it's not there because they're going to hide it in plain sight. Like, literally, it's going to be, like, sitting out front. It's like the statue in front of the Roswell UFO Museum is literally the saucer that they found, and they're like, we could just keep it outside, nobody gives a shit.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I saw some pretty interesting aircraft that were in development, but one thing I could say that you guys have touched on a lot recently is how much the government loves disinformation.
Yeah,
they have entire sectors of Area 51 that are dedicated to just going out there and spreading disinformation.
When you say disinformation, in what forms are they coming out and they're saying that aliens exist? Do you feel like this whole alien thing is just a smokescreen for what the military is actually developing themselves?
Exactly. They'd rather you think that there's aliens running around in UFOs than for you to actually, you know, hone in on any type of aircraft that they're developing. So the kookier things get, the less likely the general public is to actually believe it.
Right.
And that's good for them because they don't want you really focusing in. You know, if the public thinks Area 51 is just some Air Force, you know, base, then all the better.
Now, my question one more question for me is, what is the weirdest story that you had heard while you were working there? Was it, did anybody talk, or was it like, I imagine the people that are hired to work in Area 51 are genuinely closed mouth people. That's kind of the idea, right? Is that you have people that don't gossip.
Oh, absolutely. Just by their nature, you know, they recruit people that know how to keep their mouth shut. I mean, if you don't, you could get sued, you could get life in prison. Right. You could disappear. The weirdest thing I know of is that there are people that breach the kind of outer perimeters of Area 51 and get by those, you know, general contractor security guards, and those people just disappear.
Yeah. Hmm.
I don't know where they go. I was there during the apprehension of a few people that got a little too close to the installation. You take them into custody. You go down to level 5. You drop them off, and they're handed off to a kind of a superior officer, and that's the last that I hear or see of them.
Are there any rumors that go around, like what happens to these people? I mean, it seems truly horrific. Lord knows they're not in a great situation.
Yeah, I've heard anything from, you know, the basic, they're just forced to sign a contract that says if they say anything, it's life in prison, probably locked up somewhere, Fort Knox, you know, to the crazy where they're, you know, killed.
Yeah. What if they take those guys and they make them fucking pilots and experiment in all the new technology?
We heard about, you know, maybe they get experimented on, but we're not sure. But I would say there was a couple other things I got to see when I was there that I wrote you guys about. One of which I thought was cool is that the president's limos get outfitted with all sorts of things at Area 51. And one of the things I saw and I got to see as they were testing it, which I thought was pretty righteous but also really creepy, is this sort of, I guess, crowd control device that if too many people were to approach the president's limo or if it was under threat, it kind of disperses this gas, which from my understanding was halon, which displaces the oxygen in the area or something like that.
Whoa.
And so basically anyone in the immediate vicinity of the president's limo, and the president's limo is sealed, so he's safe in there, it would disperse this gas and just kill everyone around the limo.
Fuck yeah.
Wow.
That's
like Kissel after he's drinking all night.
Yeah, that's a good. I like that.
Yeah, it was pretty heavy. I thought it was interesting, and then I thought it was deeply disturbing because it made me realize, like, if, you know, there's a crowd of people around and then there's one hostile, I mean, if they hit this gas, they're just going to kill everyone.
Well, sticking with it being creepy and disturbing, I just want to, do you have any insight on when do you think this technology is actually going to come? Again, like I said previously, but now with all the riots happening, the police state is stronger than ever before. Was there any indication of when the military would feel comfortable releasing this kind of technology?
From my understanding, the only time they ever release any technology is when they absolutely have to. So due to a leak or the deployment of some of this technology, it was caught on video, or in the case of the bin Laden raid where they actually, you know, had to leave one of the helicopters and destroy it, but part of it was left intact. A situation like that, then they'll keep this stuff under wraps for as long as they possibly can. And one thing I got to see, which to me answered a lot of my questions about the possibility of UFOs, is an aircraft in development called the Phineas. And the Phineas, I don't know why it's called the Phineas, is basically a long cylindrical tube. And I was about 100 yards from this. I was on the airstrip providing direct observation security as they were running this test. It's, I guess I'd liken it to like a torpedo where one pilot kind of lays down in it. And it doesn't have to, it doesn't take off long ways like a jet or anything. The Phineas can basically, the pilot gets in it and it immediately just jumps up into the air from where it was. It kind of sits back, shoots directly up into the air. It can go in any direction. It can stop on a dime. It can go up. It can go down. I have no idea how the propulsion system works for anything like that. But it was probably the most radical thing I had ever seen. I mean, it can go low to the ground. It can go straight up. It can
ISIS
spin.
ISIS has got to be scared.
I hope they – it seems like they should be. Yeah.
Scared.
Yeah. Speaking of being
so – One thing I wanted to touch on was I did have a disturbing encounter while I was still with Aussie. And this was actually in 2013. See, I was stationed at Area 51 from 2010 to 2012. And so after that, I continued to work for Aussie until later I exited the military. And I went on a an intelligence gathering operation that was actually took place in the country. It was close to the Great Basin National Parks in Nevada. And while I was supposed to collect human intelligence, which is actually visually observe and record a group of people who are of specific interest to the government, so they may or may not be, you know, hostile to the United States, possibly a terrorist cell. We weren't really sure. We weren't given a ton of information. So I went out there in a small team of four guys, and it was about, I have to say, maybe 03, so it's probably about 3 a.m. when we went out there. We hiked into the South Snake Mountains and eventually got to the grid location where these individuals were supposed to be. And out there, kind of on a field, were these two sheds, which you'd find at like a Home Depot or something. You know those quick to set up sheds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was two of them kind of connected to each other, like someone had cut the back off of one and made kind of like a little corridor going to the other one, and there were some tarps surrounding that. And we were able to see a few individuals going in and out of there. And we were maybe, I don't know, 200 meters away. And we recorded this, and we decided to move a little closer. And I was separated from two of the individuals in my group. So we moved about 50 to 60 meters closer so we could get a better view of things. And this was just my experience. I'm not telling anyone what happened. I'm just saying what I saw and what I experienced. As we were recording them, there was a kind of a high frequency tone emitted, like a really loud, I don't know, dog whistle. And there was a big flash of kind of white light, like someone threw a flashbang or something inside the sheds. We could see that, and it killed all our electronics. It even scrambled our NVGs, our night vision goggles. They got kind of fried. They weren't working right. Our radios stopped working. We weren't in communication with the other two individuals that were kind of located on the other side of where we were. Everything was fried, all our electronics. And this took about, I guess it would be about 2 minutes till things started coming back online, like our radio actually came back online and everything. And we could see no movement down there from that point on. It didn't look like anyone was in the shed any longer. So we couldn't stand it, and my superior made the call to actually go down there and see what occurred. So we went down there. We were able to physically link up with the two other members of our group, and we all confirmed that we experienced the same thing, a loud, high-frequency kind of almost dog whistle and a kind of blinding white light. We entered the structure. It was on a kind of cheap concrete foundation, which is important because in the first shed, there was a bunch of maps of U.S. cities set up, and then there were some other cities on there, Paris, Rome, Cairo, Tokyo, along with a bunch of grid coordinates and a bunch of tarps, and then there was a couple tables. Nothing else in the first shed. We walked through the little corridor into the second shed, and there was four steel chairs that were kind of drilled, fastened to the concrete foundation through the shed that had chains fixed to each of the chairs, I guess, where they would, keep someone chained up. I'm not really sure. And there was an entire case full of DVD covers where you would keep DVDs. We found no recording equipment of any kind, but there was a bunch of DVD covers. I guess they made a DVD. They would, put it in one of the covers and log it and date it. I don't know. A lot of the cases had dates on them. But the more bizarre thing is that no one was there.
Wow. So you basically watched people like just disappear out of the shed.
Right. And I wish there was some more interesting things in the shed. I don't know if they took stuff with them. All I can say is 100% certainty, all four of us, and we're professional individuals. We had like a combined total of 30 years military experience. And these were all straight guys. We all experienced the exact same phenomenon. We know for a fact that there were individuals at this location. We saw them go in and out, regular humanoid-looking people. All of our stuff was fried. We were recording it. That was fried. There was nothing on the recording device after that point. We all saw the same bright white light and the high frequency emission. Everyone was gone. And we don't know exactly what happened. Later, during our debriefing with our superiors, we were basically told to forget about the entire thing.
Great. And you're like, oh, definitely.
Yeah. No, oh, not yeah, a problem there.
Yeah, certainly no, not gonna think I mean, about that, that. That led to me, exiting the military after a while. It was deeply disturbing. I'm positive of what I saw. It scared the shit out of me. I'm convinced there's a lot of weird stuff going on.
Exactly. And, I'd rather I'll just discover the joy of making pizza.
Why not?
Or, maybe I'll get into painting watercolors of pelicans and stuff like that.
Trevor, I just going to ask, just lastly, what is, after your experience with the military, what frightens you the most right now? What keeps you awake at night? Is it terrorism? Is it the idea of a UFO? Or is it just what the U.S. government is currently doing in their black ops programs?
It's a shadow government. I'm convinced there's a shadow government.
Yeah.
I think what does that mean?
What does that mean to you? When you say shadow government, can you let us visualize it a little bit in your perspective?
Well, it's difficult for me to articulate it to you. All I can say is that as I moved through my career in the military, and as I got a higher security clearance, and as I was responsible for more things, being at Area 51, you almost felt this sort of resistance or this presence that was operating beside of you. People in and out that you had never seen before, levels that you should have access to but you don't, communication with, filing reports for people that you don't know who they are. You have to fill out a report for your superiors, and then you have to fill out a subsequent report that goes you don't know where. People who disappear and are never heard from again, supervisors, a lieutenant colonel who got into an altercation with someone at Area 51, never heard from him again, never saw him.
Do you think that also, but I think that there's both insidious reasons for this and also stuff like they have to build paper trails for the money that they spend, right?
So I think that's probably true, but there's definitely, I don't believe the president of the United States is the commander in chief. I don't believe he's in charge of anything. I don't believe Congress is in charge of anything. I don't know that that's a deliberate front. I just think that the buck sort of stops somewhere and is picked up by somebody else who actually gets to make certain calls. I'll give you an example. There's a little town outside of, and I always laugh, we always used to make fun of it, outside of Area 51 called Rachel. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's got a population of about 50. Half those people work for the government.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've heard that there are towns where outside of Area 51 where it's like everybody who's there works for the government. They're like
the people who work
at the commissary at Area 51. They're like cooking the food and janitors and shit. They're all like living right outside of it.
Well, it just goes to show, I work for the Office of Special Investigations for the Air Force. I had a top secret security clearance. I had that strange experience in the South Snake Mountains, and I was told to just never mention it again. So there's something going on that's above the heads of a lot of high-ranking people. I just don't know what it is. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm scared shitless now, if that makes a difference.
Well, yeah. All
right.
You know what? It does.
It does. Yeah,
it does.
That's amazing.
Well, I hope that you do well in whatever harmless business you choose now.
Yeah.
And if the government's going to kill you, it'll kill us as well.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of rolling around like a vagrant, smoking a lot of Kush and hanging out.
That sounds great.
That's great.
That's
Trevor.
A way to do it.
Thank you so much for your insights. That was really important stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, I love it.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys. Thank you for your time. Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. Right. Thank you so much for giving me the boner I currently have. This is really great. Thank you so much.
All right, guys.
All right.
Bye.
You're an Iraq War veteran, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
All right, great.
Are you still there or are you here? Are you back home?
No, I actually am in Albany now.
Oh, nice.
Is it better or worse than Iraq?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Really good question. All right, we're back.
Some days it's hard to tell.
We got another caller. It's an honor to have him. Thank you for your service. Tamim, he's a former veteran of the Iraq War, and he's got some incredible tales for us about his experience. Thanks so much for being here, man.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, man. So is this like a funny story or is this like a bad story?
I guess it's got funny moments.
Oh, but
it's,
cool.
Yeah. No, so I was deployed to Iraq in 2007. And like August, we got over there to Baghdad. And we were in like the southern part of the city. And so my company was tasked with kind of cleaning out this area that was like a den for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, guys. Which, funny enough, the head dude that we were looking for the whole time we were there is Omar el-Baghdadi, who's the head of ISIS now.
Fuck.
Yep, big-time guy.
So did he get away on, like, roller skates, or is it, like, one of those? Was he dressed as a sexy lady, and then he goes through, like, a mall kind of thing? Is that how they get away from these circumstances, or...?
I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah, the roller skates with like a burqa, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So you're looking for Baghdadi. That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a big kind of mission task for our company because that area was like their last stronghold in Baghdad during the surge there.
Mm-hmm.
So we got over there and we took over this building that was a Catholic seminary or former Catholic seminary. And for years, the U.S. government had been trying to get the Catholic Church to let us use it as an outpost because it was like really strategically located. It was in a good spot.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't let us for like years. They wouldn't let the government use the site until the cardinal got dragged out into the street and got beheaded in front of everybody.
Yeah, that's how you motivate these fucking priests.
Yeah. So shortly after that, they said, all right, you have our blessing, so you guys can use it. So we got in there, we fortified it, we took like a couple of pretty big attacks, like initially taking over, because there hadn't really been a presence down there at all for like, you know, years at that point.
Yeah, that must have been really hairy.
So when you say you're trying to fortify it, it's obviously still a soft target at this time. What were these attacks like? Were they extremely primitive or were they very organized?
Oh, they were organized. Like, it kind of blew my mind. The first day we were on the ground there, they called in like a fake vehicle-borne VBIED threat, and they said there was a bus out in sector. We got this tip that there was a bus that was being used as like a massive car bomb, and they were going to drive it into the building that we were taking over. So they sent a platoon from my company out to go check it out, and it turned out it was bogus. They got ambushed while they were out there.
Fuck.
So they ended up making it back to the base without any casualties or anything. And but the bad guys followed him back to the base. And so within probably 30 minutes of them crossing the line back into the, you know, the perimeter there, we got just lit up by RPGs, PKM machine guns, AK-47 sniper fire, just everything you can imagine. They threw it at us.
Yeah. And I want to get to the story in a second, but just in that scenario, what's your brain going through at that time? You were just, I assume, having a normal day trying to, you know, fortify the space, and next thing you know, you're fighting for your life. How confusing is it?
It was, you know what, honestly, like, my brain just kind of, like, shut off. I don't remember very clear details. I remember almost, like, snapshots of things that happened throughout that whole fight, because, I mean, it lasted 6 hours probably until they finally petered off. Yeah.
So what do? Do they just keep going and going until you either kill all of them or they leave? It's like because they're not going to come and take a fortified U.S. base, right? They can't get in there. You guys got exoskeletons, literally like 10-foot tall exoskeletons.
Right. No, ours were on order. We didn't have them yet.
Yeah.
No, they, you know what, that's the thing that was kind of, I guess I almost want to say like awe-inspiring about that attack was because it really showed their resolve because they, you know, they kept coming in waves. They were a lot more organized than we thought. They were using trucks to like pull wounded people out of the fight and bring like reinforcements in. They were bringing ammo into their guys. I mean, they were like really set up, and it wasn't until we got the attack helicopters in to just start like dropping missiles on like every fucking building around us that, oh, sorry for cursing, by the way. I'm sure it's okay though, right?
It's okay. Yeah. Just fine.
I've been listening long enough that, by the way, side note, Om Shinrikyo was the first like series that I ever heard from you guys. And I'm interested in the adventures of young Sapien. What's he up to these days?
Man, he's just trying to be a good student, and I imagine he's gotten very large.
I'm sure he has.
Young Sapien.
Well, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, no, I love you guys. You guys put out an awesome show.
Thanks, man.
Abe Lincoln's Top Hat. Listen to it every week. So.
Thanks so much,
That's
man.
That's awesome.
Well,
man.
We'd love to have you back. We'll have you on that show, too. We'll speak at more length. But, okay, so let's go back to Iraq.
Let's get to it. Okay. This horrible story.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So, we're like, the story took place. We were probably in country maybe like 4 months at that point, and things had been kind of just like a steady, just grind. You know what I mean? Like, we were getting in fights like every other day and just kind of making our presence known, killing guys, taking dudes, like, you know, bagging them up and sending them to detainee centers and stuff like that. And there was this neighborhood that was to the south of where our outpost was, and it was like the predominantly Christian area of that part of Baghdad. And, you know, when in 03, when everything just kind of collapsed into absolute anarchy, a lot of the Christians just like got the hell out of there as quickly as they could. But the ones that couldn't really like afford to leave or just got kind of trapped there ended up in like a really bad spot. So there was like mass executions. There was just all kinds of really terrible shit that was happening to these people. And as a result, like their whole little like neighborhood was just totally abandoned. And, you know, there was people that still lived in our sector. There was commerce that went on. Markets were open. People went to work, et cetera, et cetera. But that area was like dead. So we never really patrolled in there just because there was nothing. There was no activity. There was no reason to really. But one night we were out on night patrol and we got this, you know, just kind of like a frago mission to just go like, check it out and, just see if there was any kind of like caches or signs of insurgent movement, whatever. And so, you know, we got in there, we started going kind of house to house and we were just, you know, breaking down doors and searching places. Most of the houses weren't even locked. The front doors were just hanging open. You know, shit was just strewn all over the front lawns of these places and in the streets and stuff. But then some of the houses, they looked like, you know, it's almost like that cliche where it's like dinner was still like sitting on the table. You know what I mean? From like years prior.
Crazy.
And so, yeah, it was really eerie. Like, as soon as we got in there, the feeling was just kind of like, man, uncomfortable being in there, you know?
Yeah, well, that's why I could never be in the military. I would have definitely eaten some. I would have had some old naan for sure. It would have
been tasty. Like
botulism or something. So anyways, yeah, so we go to this. There's this one house in particular that we cleared it, got up to the roof. And I don't know if you guys have seen examples of kind of like what this like Middle Eastern architecture looks like, especially in Iraq, but it's predominantly like concrete boxes really that they make the houses out of. And then they add on just like ad hoc like structures here and there, like little rooms made out of bricks, like and so this house had like a brick kind of room that had been constructed on the roof of this house as like an additional, you know, whatever storage area or something. At least that's what we thought it was initially. And so it had no windows. It had one door, and the door was like this sheet metal kind of thing, right? And it was locked, which was, you know, not a big deal, but it was locked from the inside, which was like kind of strange. And so I just kind of had this feeling like I just wanted to know what the fuck was in there. You know what I mean? Like, and my platoon sergeant even was like, just, you know, let's fucking go. Like, we don't need to know what's in there. But I just felt like I had to see it. And so we had like breaching tools that we would always carry. And I just went to town on this door and I was just working it, working it, working it. Finally, I got it to pop off its hinges. And it kind of just like fell open, right? And the first thing that I noticed when this door popped open was the smell that came from inside of that room. And I, you know, it's like it wasn't like a decay smell. It wasn't like a rotting smell. Because I mean, I've seen and smelled fucking dead bodies. I know, you know, I know what that smells like. This smelled like freshly dead people, like a butcher shop kind of, like just lots of like that heavy copper. Kind of like blood smell, exactly. Right. And it was pitch black inside. And so we put our nods down, the night vision goggles. We put the goggles down. We went in to start clearing this room. And it was like a hallway that kind of teed off at the end into two other. There was like a T intersection with rooms on either side. And like as soon as you cross the threshold, this is just like eerie, just uncomfortable feeling, you know what I mean? Like just kind of just gross. And and the smell, you know, that's like my kind of strongest sense memory of the whole thing. And so anyway, we start clearing it and we go down one side. On the right side there was a room that had a metal bed frame and it had wires that were attached to it that were attached to a car battery that was in the corner. And there was like chains on this fucking bed, right? And it was just like, you know, as soon as we saw it, I was like, what the fuck? Oh shit. Well, they're electrocuting people, obviously, in this place, right?
I thought it was just and, a strange car.
Right.
Yeah, the world's worst time machine.
Yeah. No, it was the first Tesla.
Yeah, exactly.
So then we checked the room on the left, and the room on the left had like a concrete floor. It had manacles that were kind of like coming out of the, that were like attached to the ground. And then there was like chains with manacles on the wall.
God.
And there was blood everywhere in this room. And
did you find a small box that if you turned it in such a way, Pinhead would appear? I mean, this is absolutely horrific.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And so the blood was just everywhere. And it was, the weirdest thing was because this room had obviously been locked. You know what I mean? And the evidence from the neighborhood around it had kind of given us the idea that this had been an unoccupied area. Nobody'd been in there for probably months, if not years, up to that point, right? And this blood was basically, like, wet almost, still on the ground. So it's like, where the fuck did that come from? You know what I mean? And so, yeah, it was just super creepy. It put everybody's hackles up. As soon as we saw that, we were just like, let's get the hell out of here. And so we left, and I remember thinking that the strangest thing that bothers me to this day, the reason I still think about it, is because the door was locked from the inside with a padlock, but there was no way to get out of that room except for the door that was locked from the inside.
Interesting.
Oh my God, that's so creepy.
God help us.
Right?
You know, so everybody's got a hobby.
Yeah. Maybe the bed frame really was a teleport device to another dimension.
That just is so bizarre that you would find something. And so, you know, of course, like here, we find something like that, you're going to call the police. But there, you find it and you're just like, yeah, let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, let's get the fuck out of here.
Like, let's just leave this alone and never think about it ever again.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go back to the base and just, like, you know, watch, I don't know.
Everybody loves Raymond.
Yeah, girls.
Yeah, put on Adventure Time and just sit and watch it.
So at that point, were you so desensitized to violence at that point, you just sort of took that in and you go back? And then when you finished your tour and you got a little time to reflect on your experience, I mean, how did you feel about what you experienced over there with a little reflection back here in the States?
You know, I'm... It's a kind of a complicated thing to talk about or think about, but
yeah,
you know, like when we were that area that we were in Baghdad, just in a general sense, like we did a lot of good. I firmly believe that, like we did a lot of good because there was tons of sectarian violence that was going on when we were there. Sunnis were killing Shia like every day, wholesale. which actually I have another story, which was kind of not necessarily as eerie, but every day, like for the first couple months that we were there, we would find these decapitated bodies like on street corners. Like it was a pretty regular occurrence to find these bodies in the morning. And we always wondered, well, where the hell did that, where were the heads? We never found any of the heads, right? And about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months later, we were doing this big clearing mission through this palm forest that was to the south of the city. And we found this mud hut that had, like, no shit, a pyramid, like a pyramidal structure of heads that were stacked up inside this building. And the ones on the bottom were skulls because they decayed already at that point, and the ones on the top were fresh.
Oh, my God.
At some point, one of the guys said, like, be like, hey, Ryan, can you stop piling these heads because it's creeping me out? Like, it's got to make them sort
of put them in the hole with the rest of
well, it's, in the hole.
Did you tell me? I'm just trying to have fun. You said have fun with it. Be creative.
Did you find it to be sort of a shrine? Was this something that you think that they went back to on a regular basis and took great pride in?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you think they do this shit mostly to they do this shit to freak people out though? Isn't that kind of the idea that they do these crazy horrible looking things in order to make you feel fear of them?
100%. Yeah, 100%. Cuz I mean the actual physical beheadings themselves took place in public, you know what right. I mean? And they would try and get, like, a crowd of people around them.
Because, yeah, look how horrible we are. We're, you know, like, you can't beat us. We do this kind of shit.
Yeah,
this being like, we have 10-foot exoskeletons with gigantic electronic batons. We're coming for you, literally in 10 years. Sorry, guy. You know.
Speaking of, like, advanced weaponry and stuff like that, too, we had this thing towards the end of my tour. This is absolutely true. It was a microwave gun that we used for crowd control. And so it was on our vehicles. We got like a test unit of it, and we had it on one of our vehicles. And it was like a big satellite dish looking thing that was on a turret, and it had crosshairs, and you like sat inside and you pointed it at people. And when you turned it on, it microwaved people.
Fuck. So they get like really hot?
Do they explode?
No, they would just get this really terrible, like, burning sensation on their skin and, like, in their bodies. And so nobody was able to stand it for longer than a couple of seconds before they just ran away.
Cool.
Oh, my God. Well, what? I can't wait for that to come to the streets of New York.
I know.
It's going to be here soon.
Well, thank you, man. I'm so glad you're safe and back, dude.
Yeah, dude.
No, thanks for having me on the show, guys. Seriously, I appreciate it. Love you guys' work. Henry, I can't wait for my pretty face to come back.
Dude, October 23rd, I can't fucking wait. It's really good. It's really, really good. You did good.
Thank you, Tamim. Thank you for your service. Thank you for everything you've done.
Hail Satan, dude.
Hail Satan.
Woo! Hail yourself.
Have fun in Albany.
Well, that's impossible.
Go on down to a live show sometime. We'll get you in for free.
Okay. Awesome, man. Thank you.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah, dude. We'll see you soon.
All right, so we got Seattle McMuttonberry?
Mattenberry.
I don't think it's a real name.
Fake Seattle name. McMuttonberry.
Seattle McBone.
You got it right.
Well, he's on the phone with us, and he has a story about an airplane, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
All right, Seattle, start us off wherever the hell you want to.
All right, so 2012 summer, I was flying back from Europe. We were doing this European tour with one of my bands, and it was me, my drummer Frank, and his girlfriend on the flight back, and we board the plane and we're looking for our seats, and there's this man who has just sitting next to me who's like he's got to be like 300 pounds, and he did not look like in good shape, and I had to the seats were like in the middle of the plane, not like on the other windows. So I actually I tried to wake him up to get to my seat and he didn't respond. So I had to like go all the way around and like make these two old ladies get up to get to my seat.
Oh yeah.
But about halfway through the flight, he calls for a flight attendant, and He says, "Hey, I'm having trouble breathing. I'm a diabetic, and I haven't had my medicine."
God, and, why would you get on a plane from fucking Europe without your shit?
I know, right? Yeah.
And is he this said the he world's take... most inconvenient suicide?
I mean, he hadn't taken it in like 24 hours, and he would. So they brought him oxygen. They made an announcement that, you know, hey, if anyone on the flight is a doctor or a nurse.
Who's got extra insulin? You know, which one of you, I see you, thin woman. Do you have extra insulin?
And so they decide to move him to the back of the plane so he can stretch his legs so they don't clot up. And
this is a good move for you, Kissel, in the plane.
I am going to really do this. Yes.
Yeah. But so he, about a half hour later, he comes back to his seat and he's... He didn't need help or anything. He was walking with his cane. He was fine and sat down. And I asked him, like, "Hey, you feeling better? Is everything okay?" And he's like, "Yes, my son's a doctor and he lives in Houston. I'm flying to and I'll be fine." So I put my headphones in and I'm watching a movie. And about 45 minutes after that, I just feel a cup drop and hit my foot. And I look over at him and he's hunched over, just foam, white foam coming out of his mouth. Yeah, and so I start freaking out. I'm like standing up in my seat and hitting the flight attendant button, screaming for help. And yeah, and so they like some people grabbed him, and flight attendants grabbed him, and there was just no dignity to this man's death. They just
down the aisle like he's a fucking barrel.
No, exactly. Yeah. They drug him down the aisle and put him in like the snack cubby where they like curtain. They just drug him into and put him in the snack cubby and just close the curtain.
I don't want to be insensitive here, but the man was a diabetic. He was morbidly obese. This is the proper burial in the sky snack cubby.
That's how they do it.
This is fine. I have no problem with the way this guy is gone.
Did he shit his pants?
Well, no, okay, so here, so I, we're gonna get to that. So okay. I'm kind of freaking out, and
well, this is a problem too. Says also on a plane, I would say, to be honest, in this scenario, I wouldn't say anything. I would literally go and put a sleep mask on him and be like, "Oh, somebody's taking a nap," just because they are not turning this plane around. I need to get where I'm going.
Sure.
So I'm kind of freaking out, and the flight attendants get my friend and who is about 20 seats behind me, and they're like, "Hey, is that your friend up there in the red shirt? You know, I think he could just need someone to talk to you. If you could like come talk to him." So he sits down. And I told him like everything that happened, and he's like, "Oh fuck, dude, like that's crazy." And he goes, "Wait a minute, was he sitting in this seat?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, well if you're cool, I'm gonna go back to mine because this seat's wet."
Yeah, bro. You wanted your friend to come sit in the corpse's seat? And first, how did you get an upgrade out of this? How did you get bumped up to business?
Did you at least get free headphones?
I don't know. I mean, the flight was almost over, but the big twist that I sent this to Marcus before any of this happened, when we were on the flight, people were still boarding. While he was sleeping, sitting next to me, I took a selfie with him.
Oh,
all right, let's see it.
I sent it to Marcus.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Took a selfie with a dead man.
A future dead man.
Oh, he does look like he's having trouble.
All right. So what inspired you to take the selfie with the future corpse?
Well, it was my first, you know, trip to Europe, and I just thought it was funny that, like, end the trip, I was, you know, having to sit next to this man who was, like,
huge man,
halfway in my seat.
Yeah.
And so while I was sleeping, I just, you know, snapped a little selfie.
Wow.
Wow. So.
Yeah, so I have the last picture with this guy.
Now,
so do we know any, first of all, did you get a free flight?
Nope, I didn't get anything out of it. I just kind of, nothing happened.
Did they let him out of the snack cubby?
Ever? Or is he still there?
I don't, so when I, my drummer and his girlfriend, when they were leaving, like walking down the aisle, he like peeked in and to like in the curtain to see if he was in there. And like, yeah, I mean, his shirt was open and it was like he was all blue and
oh my god.
Yeah. We had to make an emergency landing.
Did
and
they put him but, on fucking yeah. like the baggage claim?
How do you get, I don't know what you do with him, yeah.
Good lord.
Call Mexican. There's got to be like a corpse story. Closet in all airports. There has to be, every airport has to have some sort of protocol because people have to die on planes all the time.
One of the flight attendants talked to me. He said he'd been doing it for like 15 years. He said that was like the sixth time that's happened.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm horrified.
Since he'd been a flight attendant, yeah.
I'm going to die on a plane. I know I am.
Well, it just seems very accurate. If you got diabetes, you're done. Wow, well, what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it.
That is great.
You know, I don't think it was wrong of you to take that selfie. You didn't know he was going to die.
You're being an investigative journalist. Yeah, that's technically, you're just in the moment.
That's it.
Man.
Well, thanks for having me on, you guys. This
thank you
awesome.
for saying that horrible story. That's great, man. Thank you. We're calling.
Yeah, can I do a little a plug for my band?
Yeah, sure.
I was actually going to ask.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, so I'm in this. I'm sure there's a lot of grindcore and like death metal fans out there listening to last
Richard
podcast.
Richard Gyfus.
I'm in a band called Cryptic Void. You can go to crypticvoid.bandcamp to check us out. It's just kind of like, you know, old school grindcore death metal influence. We're actually coming to doing a whole European tour next year, sometime in the summer. Still figuring out those dates. And, you guys should check it out.
Hell yeah, dude.
We'll check that out. That sounds great, man.
People will. I will say, if you are on a seat next to Seattle, move, because you'll die.
You're going
to
die.
You're the cursed one, I think.
Yeah, my bandmates were making jokes, like telling me that I have to ride a Greyhound next time we do a tour. You know, I can't. I'm not allowed to be in the van. Oh, yeah,
no one dies of a heroin overdose in the bathroom of a Greyhound.
Oh, no. Never.
No, it never happens.
Thank you so much, buddy. Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. Thanks, guys.
Hail yourself, buddy.
Yeah, dude.
All right. Our next caller, his name is Jared. He's got a creepy tale for all of us.
He's not the sandwich-loving pedophile.
No, he's not.
We know that now.
Mm-hmm. Hate that asshole.
Yeah.
Yes, good. He ruined
That's
your
a
name.
Good stance. That's yes. a very good stance. So you have a doppelganger, or believe you do?
Yes, I do. At least I think I do. I've never personally seen him, but I've had a lot of family members report that they've seen him from around 2 to 5 years old.
Interesting.
All right, so you're 2 years old. Your parents, obviously, you're not really there mentally yet, but your parents claim that there was another two-year-old running around the house, huh?
Yeah, basically. See, my parents, we built our house in a suburb up here in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, when I was around 2, and then we moved in the house when I was about 3. And since then, they've on and off reported seeing him or hearing him or such.
And how does he show himself? How does he show himself to your parents?
The first time he was seen, it was actually my dad who didn't see him, but he heard him. When I was little, I had a room directly next door to their room. And because the house wasn't completely finished, the bathroom closest to me wasn't done, but theirs was. So every once in a while, being kind of afraid of the house because the house has always been a little creepy to me in a sense, like very oppressive almost, I would run through their room into their bathroom to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about a weekly, maybe bi-weekly thing. So it wasn't exactly rare, but it wasn't common either. And one night my dad just says that he was laying in bed sleeping just completely fine. And all of a sudden he heard the sound of footsteps running past him. So he woke up and looked through the light and there was nothing. He tried to urge my mom awake to possibly check on me. But when they got the bathroom door open, they found no one in there. Lights off. I was dead asleep in my bed.
Hmm.
Interesting.
So your doppelganger had to pee in the middle of the night.
So
yes.
How were they sure that this wasn't just a ghost and not your it was your doppelganger? So they saw you. In places where you shouldn't be. Yes, that was the first time.
Yeah.
So how did it develop?
The second time was maybe about a year later. My mom, I had an early bedtime because I was a little kid, obviously. And since my room was right next door to theirs, my mom would often have to walk past my room to get to bed. And so she would often just look over, just make sure I was asleep, everything was okay. And one night she's walking through the hall into her room, and she turns her head, And just for a brief second, she recognizes that I'm standing right by the bedpost, fully dressed, fully awake, just staring straight at her. She doesn't realize it, of course, so she just looks over to her room and then, freaking out because it's the middle of the night, I shouldn't be awake, I should be in bed. She turns her head. I'm fast asleep, completely in my pajamas, asleep in the bed.
Interesting. Hmm. I actually feel like that's kind of a, it's more, instead of a ghosty thing, it's more of a glitch in the Matrix type thing. It seems to be a, she's like creating you. It's probably, because they were new parents, right? Did you have brothers and sisters before that? Do you have older?
No, I'm the only child.
So I wonder.
Or not an only child, I'm one younger.
You have one younger. So I feel like, I imagine, to be honest, well, I don't know anything about raising children and probably will never know.
Never know.
But I think that, you know, what could have happened is that they're literally overwhelmed with having a new child and literally they're seeing you everywhere. And it's like, in your reality's thin, right? So they're literally putting you in places. Unless this is a common occurrence in your family, has this happened to anybody else?
It's happened to my grandmother, actually. This was probably, I'd say, less than a year later. Often during the weekends, my parents would take me out and just hang with their friends and whatever. Their friends had kids my age. I was out of the house most weekends. But we always left the house doors unlocked, so often my grandparents would come by to check on the house, just make sure everything's okay. One day, my grandma is driving past the house, and she looks into the window and just sees me just standing there with the curtains pulled around me.
Hmm.
I'm just standing there looking out the window, looking at her. So obviously, she's kind of like freaked out, like, why am I home alone? I'm about 4. I shouldn't be left alone at home. And so she parks, walks up to the door, opens it, searches the entire house. I'm gone. She calls my parents. I'm with them. About 50 miles away.
Wow.
So you're never alone. Did you ever try to speak to your doppelganger?
I've never personally seen it, but I have kind of felt its presence almost. A lot of the time when I was growing up in the house, I would always feel like something was watching me, or I was never alone in a room. And a couple times, like, I've been inside one room and then I leave for a couple minutes and I come back and things are moved around. Or in one particular case, we had a tub full of Legos that was just sitting in the middle of the floor. No way it could, like, have been moved or anything like that. I leave, and I hear the sound of it crashing over onto its side.
Hmm. All right. Actually, do you know anything about the concept of doppelgangers, Marcus? Have you read any? Like, I know it is a lot of times it's labeled under glitches in the Matrix / ghosts, like weird reality occurrences.
I mean, not really. I mean, really, like doppelgangers and things like that. That's more like old school folklore, type of stuff. Yeah, there isn't. It's not really anything that's in like the current paranormal community that really gets into doppelgangers hardcore.
And there's a great book called The Double. That's about that, too. That's very, very good.
Well, that's great. So, Jared, any other stories you want to share with us?
Not any ones that spring to mind. Like I said, it's just rare occurrences. Around the time that my brother was born, it just, every single sighting of him just disappeared.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder if that's just because you're getting older. And I think it's kids obviously, they attract more paranormal activity and they give off more energy because literally their brains are growing. So they're like little fountains of energy.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Well, either way, if he was anything like you, he was an adorable doppelganger. What a doppelganger he was.
Yes.
His name is Diraj, which is Jared backwards.
And the evil Jared would have been happy to have seen the two young boys running around his sex den rather than just
the one. I think he's probably the good Jared. I feel like I'm more the evil Jared.
Yeah.
So
you're a murderer.
I can't say that.
Thank you.
That's good.
Let's not say that. Good stance. That's what you do.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Jared. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hail sweet Satan, buddy.
Hail yourself.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Bye.
The next caller is Olivia. Her mother was almost a victim of a very famous serial killer. Is that correct? Olivia is with us.
All right. So, Charles Cullen, he was a nurse who was a serial killer in the area where I grew up and I live now. And not a lot of people know about him, which is kind of scary in my opinion, because they get treated at the same hospitals that kind of helped cover it up.
Cool.
What he was doing. And my grandfather, when he was really sick, and he was in the Somerset ICU, and the doctor, I believe, gave him about a 20% chance of surviving. So Charles Cullen, who claimed to be an angel of mercy, we believe that he kind of fit like the profile exactly. And like long story short, my grandfather, when he was in the step down unit, so after his recovery, in the same hospital where Charles Cullen was killing, and he put on the TV, and they basically found out right then that Charles Cullen was charged with murdering a whole bunch of people while he was the nurse, and he pointed to the TV and said, that's the man that tried to kill me.
Whoa. So how did he stop him from killing him?
Well, I believe my mom was kind of responsible for why my grandfather is still here today, because she got special orders from her doctor to stay over in the ICU overnight, which you're not supposed to do. And she was with him all the time. And Charles Cullen was responsible for kind of spiking all the IV bags. And
that's what I heard. Yeah, because so he would come in the night while the person was asleep and essentially inject bad shit into the, or like, you know, give the, they were saying like it's overdosing them essentially.
Insulin mostly.
Yeah, and my grandfather was in there for pancreatitis, and he did kind of have like ups and downs and a lot of really bad episodes in the hospital, which when I read about Charles Cullen, a lot of his other victims, they had that kind of spiking up and down and overdosing on insulin.
So how many years did this guy operate for? I know usually these nurse serial killers, it's extremely difficult for them to be caught. You need such a huge amount. I mean, people go to the hospital to die, so when they leave in a body bag, it's not necessarily such a huge red flag.
It was many years.
So well like, over 20 years.
Yeah.
About 20, I think he made it 25 years.
So your grandfather was one of the later victims.
Or almost one of the later victims.
Yeah, he was in the hospital. The Somerset Hospital was where he was caught, and he was still in the hospital while he was charged.
It's horrifying. Do you give any credence to this idea that the serial killer himself did think he was doing good?
Yeah, I believe that he liked to play God. He was really religious from what I know, and even when he was in prison, he donated an organ, so he was still kind of playing with like people's difference between life and death.
Cool. Who wants the organ from prison?
I'd take it.
Take it if
I'd
you take need
any
it.
Organ.
Yeah,
I'd take pig organ.
Well, I guess you wouldn't have to go to nursing school. They tend you can you learn what the person knows.
I had this idea the other night that I was poo-pooed for, which is you get a scientist and you take him hostage and you tie him up in like a garage and you have him build all the shit for you, like, you know, and he'll be 3D printing all the organs for you, and then you have your own scientist. So you don't need to wait for fucking doctors.
Yeah, it sounds like every bad action movie plot of all time. Or what we did to
Iron Man. That's Iron Man. You just described the first 30 minutes of Iron Man.
Make it real.
Make it real. Well, that's so fascinating. So how is the family doing? Is everyone recovered from this disgusting, horrifying event? Are you guys scared of going to the hospital now?
I'm not really that scared, but where our local hospital is, the weird thing about it is it's the Hunterdon Medical Center in Flemington. And from doing reading, he was there for 3 years, and he said he didn't kill anybody for the first two, but he admitted to killing, I believe, at least 5 to 8 there. God. But coincidentally, the Hunterdon Medical Center destroyed all their files while they were investigating if he had killed anybody there. So to me, it was kind of suspicious that they didn't want anyone to, in my opinion, know if the nurse had been killing patients there.
They just can't let their credibility be attacked. So that's what they do, is they basically cover it up. It's like when the Secret Service killed JFK.
Yeah, actually, like, all of the hospitals he had worked at had the same thing, where they would fire him because they knew he was responsible for killing people. And it took the Somerset Center to finally become involved and led to his arrest.
Also, what they do with priests that touch kids.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Olivia. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Have fun in Jersey.
Hail your grandfather, hail yourself, and hail your mother.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Doki.
The only reason why I'm spending all my time running around between these buildings is because somebody killed a guy from the rice box.
What the hell are you talking about?
You don't tell me that I'm not just a Spider-Man. I'm a spider goddamn hero, spider soldier. That's what I need to change my damn name to. What I need is one of these 10-foot exoskeletons. I'm sick of getting so tired just jumping from building to building. The robots do it.
You're Spider-Man already, so you don't need an exoskeleton. The whole point. Anyway. That's fine.
I don't make any money.
Amazing stories. Thank you, everyone who called in. I mean, those military stories were so creepy real. The ghost tales were phenomenal.
Trolls.
Wow. Phenomenal stuff. Thank you guys so much. Marcus, great finds. We have amazing listeners. Huh?
We let you do it, and you did it.
Yep.
And you know what? You're welcome.
That doesn't make any sense.
You're welcome for us letting you do it, and you did it, and we didn't really do much, but you did it, and we did it together.
Free speech, please. You're back in the clink.
I didn't say anything rhyming with anything bad.
That's correct. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Hail yourselves. Keep on checking out all the shows here on CCR that Mr. Parks and I do. We had one listener mention Able Against Top Hat. I think we might actually try to get him back on for a longer interview. God knows what else is in the minds of these unbelievable heroes over there. And so thank you for supporting Able Against Top Hat, Roundtable of Gentlemen, The Lucky Bone Show, Bang. Sex and Other Human Activities. We have to plug Holden's new show. Otherwise, he's not going to be around long enough.
Wizard and the Bruiser.
Wizard and the Bruiser, yes.
So no one ever celebrates me. I'm a true hero. Everybody says, Spider-Man, take it, Spider-Man, for goddamn granted. Where's my interview?
Do you want an interview?
I'll tell you a scary story. One time I was going down to Mary Jane when I lifted up my head. It turned out to be the Lizard Man again.
Okay, so
I've been blowing a man.
You accidentally. How did you confuse?
I was like, your pussy's getting longer, girl. I said that to her.
It's a lizard.
And he went. Because that's the sound a lizard makes when he fucking comes in your mouth.
This seems like a difficult thing to confuse.
I'm the real American superhero.
All right.
Hellgate, one and all.
Hail yourselves.
Satan. Happy Halloween. We're building up to it. Fucking don't kill a boy this year.
Don't
ever do that. That's the rule.
This year, just try not to kill a boy.
Ever, ever, ever.
Ever, ever. Make goose-delations.
Hail me.
Never, ever.
Never once kill a boy, especially this year.